I'm fixated on this conservation idea and preservation idea because I know how happy a person can be if they move their body, eat the right food, and take a look at their surroundings, and it's wild.
How can I help? How can I be useful in ending needless suffering? Do not be afraid of work that has no end.
We have to organize a social movement.
We have an opportunity to lead by example versus just talking hot air. I think the more people in this fight, the more we grow. Eventually it could change. You know, the people are the ones that can make the change.
Welcome back, everyone. It's time for season two of Change Agents. I just finished a conversation with Donnie Vincent. He is an explorer, he's a filmmaker, a biologist, and a sportsman. And the topic, largely of today's episode, is conservation, viewed through the lens of his own experiences in the outdoors. Some stats for you here. The World Wildlife Fund has reported that there has been a 69% decline in wildlife worldwide since the 1970s. Currently, in 2023, 40% of all land on Earth has been converted to food production, which has devastating effects for wildlife. Agriculture is responsible for 90% of the global deforestation and 70% of the world's freshwater use. According to research from the Natural History Museum, humans have transformed more than 70% of land surfaces on planet Earth. Enter Donnie Vincent, who is going to share with us his thoughts and experiences. Hope you enjoy the episode.
You know, and it's really difficult to kill an animal. And so that, you know, that time frame, once you release the arrow, like you said, everything up to that arrow releasing is incredible. Killing the animal it's difficult to kill anything. And to be the one that's responsible for another is a heavy thought, but you know, that's the relationship of predator and prey. That's who we are.
For sure. You know, it's interesting. We start the conversation reviewing our hunting experiences, and the whole episode today is based around conservation. You know, you're a filmmaker, you're a biologist. You did a bunch of stuff up in Alaska. You've been a hunter for a long time. And I think people have a hard time understanding how hunting and conservation are actually tied. I'm curious your thoughts and your experience trying to connect the two with people.
Well, there's a lot of different levels. One, on the very surface, hunters and fishermen oftentimes have been kind of the front line of conservation. They're the ones that are setting up the duck decoys and hunting similar or same duck rivers, duck sloughs, lakes year in and year out. They're the ones climbing up in tree stands or hiking back into mountains to look at the elk. And so hunters and fishermen for a long time have been in more recent times have been the ones that kind of brought forth ideas of conservation and issues of conservation. If you go into the same elk valley every year, you're the frontline observer. It's not necessarily the biologist that works for the state, but you're the frontline observer where you can say, you know, we used to go back in this valley and I wouldn't see any hunters, and I was seeing 300 to 500 head of cows, and I was seeing 8 to 10 bulls, whatever. And we as observers really start to notice, if you're truly a hunter, truly a conservationist, preservationist, you start to notice, hey, I'm seeing less milkweed than I used to see. I'm seeing less snakes. I'm seeing less turtles. I'm seeing, you know, I go to my favorite trout stream and I used to catch 25 trout and I'd walk this stretch and now I'm catching two. And so you start to ask questions. And I struggled with this for a long time, Andy, because I wasn't sure why we were conservationists. I wasn't sure why we wanted to preserve land or to reclaim land or to reclaim habitat. And then the more and more I thought about it, it went back to our original society pre-agriculture of being hunters and gatherers. And I thought, I think that's why. I don't know that hunters and gatherers necessarily did things to cultivate the land, although I bet they did. I bet they knew the flowers that elk ate or grasses. I bet they knew the type of stream bed that the trout wanted. And if there was, you know, I'm making this up, but if there was a weather event that disrupted an area where the mule deer or elk were traveling, I bet these societies did something to clear that path or whatever and to enhance the animals. And I think a lot of that stuff comes from, this was our resource for life. This was our meat. This was our plants. This was our water source for life. And so I think hunting and conservation has always been connected. When I've traveled around the world, I did a bunch of work in Bangladesh, studying tigers with a professor of mine. And he cautioned me when we went to Bangladesh. He said, first of all, there are a lot of terrorists in this country that don't like Americans. So, and he said, a lot of the people that we're going to see in the jungle and around the jungle, you're the first white guy they're ever going to see. So just mind your P's and Q's, walk in a particular fashion, behave in a particular fashion, hold your head high, be confident, but don't put yourself in a bad position. That was A. B was, he said, be cautious when talking about hunting. I know you're a hunter. He obviously knew me as a biologist, but he said, I know you live to hunt. And he said, hunting here is something that is at times gets confused with being poachers or poaching and taking a resource like the Bengal tiger. But when I started talking to the Bangladeshi biologists, they said, we don't hunt. And I love this. And I've heard this throughout many places that I've traveled. They said, we no longer hunt. However, the pillars of our society, the beginning of our culture, the pillars and the leaders of our society were all the hunters in that society. And I've heard that and read that throughout time. And I think that comes from this conservation mind of, this is how we got our meat. This is how we got our berries and our grasses and our vegetables, whatever it may be, honey, bees, insects, whatever it was that we were consuming. I think that's where it comes from, and those men being leaders. And that's just kind of how it progressed until we started getting this idea of agriculture and people started having provisions brought to them. Now we could have more than one baby. Now we could be stationary to our excrement. We weren't moving away from our soils. And so we were, you know, instead of moving to where animals were moving or moving to where things were coming into bloom, we were stationary because now there's this magical grass called maize that we can grow and crush down and eat. And now we can have more than one baby. We're not getting away from our soils. And I think that kind of, I mean, we love agriculture, but that was also the degradation of how the population was going to function with the world.
Yeah, that desire to, I can see that headspace. And I've had interesting conversations with people who don't understand how somebody who appreciates wildlife or wild animals would also have the desire to hunt and kill them. And for me, when I started hunting, one of the big selling points, if you will, wasn't necessarily pitched that way, but it was in conversations with John, was in just having a better understanding of where the sustenance for my family and friends came from. I know almost nothing about where the meat comes from when I go into the grocery store, and I'm not by any stretch trying to negatively speak about what people call, you know, traditional factory farming. It's a staple of what is required for the society and the cities and the infrastructure that we have. But you do have a choice, or I have a choice, I should say, where I live. I got an amazing bull in Wyoming. I already have it in my freezer, a couple hundred pounds. It will sustain, well, my middle son eats like a garbage disposal. I was about to say it sustains us for a year, maybe three quarters of a year, depending on his consumption rate. But I know exactly where it came from, and I have that choice. I think of people in New York, you know, New York City, and again, not to speak negatively, but it's a different infrastructure. I don't, you know, other than traveling and saving and going into an environment that they're not familiar with, they may not really have a choice to detach from the factory farming model, and that's okay. But I could also see it getting lopsided, like you were saying, the society that is built. Now we don't have to move. We're not following the herds, studying the herds, living with the land. But we're also making agricultural deposits and absorbing and building on land from an agricultural perspective that is now pushing up against that wildlife. So it's a different juxtaposition. You're not out there perhaps with a bow and arrow or a rifle, but when you start taking away the lands that these animals would naturally graze in, whether it's a city or agriculture, you still have to have that conversation about conservation. It's the agricultural land and overwhelming the herds that way and moving them that way is probably slower and less painful than going out there and hunting them, but it might end up having the same result because it's displacing them.
Yeah, it's going to have a much greater result. It's going to have a a really finite result. And we're going to run out of opportunity and land here, I think, before we know it. And I think about, once we started in society, once we started staying in place, once we started improving our homes, improving our buildings, and having food and water at our disposal, well, our populations started to do something that is irrevocable. Like, it's never, ever going to go back unless we experience some, massive event in Mother Nature. Let's just say we experience a true pandemic with a virus that kills 80% of the people that it infects, and there are no recourses. Well, now we're going to get a massive reset button, or there's an ice age that comes up that is, there's a sudden event that knocks the population down to next to nothing. Then there will be a reset process. But we have gone in this direction. I don't want to say the wrong direction, because we're a modern society. We're a mechanized and organized society, but we've gone in this direction for a very long time. If we were to take the similar parameters and apply to an elk or something, look how hot a topic it is, Andy, when people want to just reintroduce a pack of wolves into a state. And we have a mule deer herd and we have an elk herd, and they're growing, and maybe they're flourishing, and maybe the grizzly bears aren't preying on them enough, or the black bears aren't preying on them enough, or the coyotes. And biologists say, hey, we think this is a large enough, wild enough landscape, we can bring in a pack of wolves. Hunters, ranchers, all these people kind of get up in arms because they think, hey, this is a tipping point. Once we add these wolves in here, it's really going to affect these ungulate populations. It's really going to affect a lot of the populations. And now this swing of predator and prey. Right now the prey is probably trending towards overpopulation. I'm making this scenario up. But once we add the wolves, it's going to start coming into balance. But once you hit balance, it then has to go to a particular direction. Either the wolves are going to overpopulate and push the prey down, and then there's going to be this kind of undulating process. Well, with human beings, no undulating process. There is no yin and yang. It has just been a steady increase for the last 15,000 years, and our cities continue to go up, our pollution continues to go up, our value of the land, our connection to the land is degrading so fast. I think when I look at, and I'm not just saying this because you're a retired Navy SEAL, but I think about some of the things that people fight about online, or you see it on social media, whether that be genders or whether that be all the hot topics that people are talking about right now. And I just think, if people walk down our streets with weapons, another country landed on our shores and started walking down our streets with weapons, all of those discussions melt away immediately. The only reason we have those discussions is because when we turn our faucet on, water comes out. When we plug our computers into the wall, electricity powers them up. As long as all that stuff works, we all keep in this mindset. And it just really worries me that the people in the high rise, the people that are running to Starbucks for their coffee, the people that haven't had that aha moment of what the land really means to us as a species, it just really worries me that we constantly celebrate the technological advances in creating laboratory meat, creating all these potential caloric systems that we can generate calories that we as human beings are going to be able to eat and do less and have to do less to get our food and to get our nutrition. I see those two things as being a massive divide between conservation and what we are as a people. And then you take the hunters, this little tiny group of hunters, and I think, and even amongst the hunters, I think it's even a smaller group, right? I think there's quite a few folks that hunt that couldn't answer these questions, have no interest in answering these questions. Get me to my next trip. Get me to my next trophy. They kind of are moving through the space as though it's a tennis tournament, or though it's a baseball game or a football game. Like, I've won the Super Bowl 3 times. I shot a 400-inch elk. To really have that connection, to really see that system, you have to dive into all of it. It can't just be the bull elk. It can't just be the mature white-tailed deer. Like, you have to really pay attention to the soils, and if the soils on up, and that's where everything starts. And if we really started to pay attention to wild places and really started to pay attention to how we do agriculture and how we raise meat, I think we would benefit greatly as a society. I don't know how we would feed everyone, or if we could feed everyone, or if we couldn't, I don't know. But we can't just keep going in the wrong direction or in the amplified direction, because that's where technology is taking us. And if we do, well, then we have to be okay with the pitfalls that come along the way.
Yeah, I have a stat in front of me that says currently 40% of all land, and I'm pretty sure by that they mean on Earth, has been converted for food production, which has devastating effects not only for wildlife, but extended out long enough, the human culture. Agriculture is responsible for 90% of global deforestation and 70% of the world's freshwater use, which speaks to your analogy between, you know, the ungulates and the wolves. People are making the decision to introduce, and I've seen it even in Montana, the argument rages on. Should wolves be put back on the list? Should they be delisted? Same with grizzlies as well. The conversation, once the population is thriving, they start taking over. They have that conversation from the wildlife conservation perspective. We're not having that conversation from a human agricultural perspective, and we're on this climb that I don't know how much land is on Earth, but at the current trajectory, we're going to top out capacity, and then we're going to have some very difficult conversations and choices after that. Or hopefully before, here, I would say. I would hope we could have those conversations before, but...
Same. And then I also think, I'm also curious, we talk about feeding the world and feeding the Earth and all this different stuff in agriculture, but then I also... and these are topics that, you know, maybe we shouldn't address, but I also think, you know, and I'm obviously in the United States, I would say 80% of the people that I see, 70 to 80% of the people that I see are morbidly obese.
Yeah.
So who are we feeding? What are we feeding them? How is that benefiting? If I could, again, and we're talking about conservation, but this is how I see conservation, and people obviously have a difficult time wrapping their heads around loving wildlife and still pressing the trigger and taking an animal's life. But really, it's a relationship between all things. It's not that we're killing this soft and cuddly animal, although it appears to be that way at a very, very surface level. But this is an engagement. This is a relationship. This is a responsibility between the elk, between human beings and wolves and coyotes. I also greatly dislike when hunters are say, oh, we got to kill all the wolves, you know, and we can't reintroduce wolves. And I'm not for wolf reintroduction everywhere they want to do it. And I think there's a lot of that stuff that gets done for the fancy free of the tourists, right? Like a state like Colorado might be like, hey, we want to put wolves on our license plates. So let's reintroduce them so we can put wolves on our license plates. Then we can maybe draw more federal dollars to, you know, work on our endangered species. Who knows why the politics of things. No one's telling the truth. No one tells the truth anymore. And so everything that you read and kind of digest comes with a spin. But if we don't start looking at this stuff on the deepest of levels, then I don't know what it is that we're doing even as a species. Are we just trending towards a Andy, have you ever watched the movie WALL-E? With one of your kids?
I'm sure I have. I have a deep and robust iTunes library of movies I'll never watch again that are targeted towards 5 to 7 year olds.
So this movie, I watched this, I have a 7 year old, and I watched this with him, and I thought, holy shit, like this is maybe where we're going. And it was, Earth was a ruin. It still existed. There were still things on Earth, but Earth was a ruin. And all the human beings lived above Earth in massive spaceships that just orbited Earth. And they all drove around on these little scooters, picture a lark, and all the scooters had a computer screen on them. And people were just these huge fat slobs, like their legs didn't even work anymore. And they would just drive around on these scooters eating this stuff and just working on the computer. And Earth was just below them as a ruin. And that's kind of the trend that I see coming. Like people, if I could convince people, or if you could somehow hit a magic button and just say, look, and I mean this, I'm not just saying this because I'm talking to you, look, everyone has to work out. If you don't work out, and I mean seriously work out, your life energy gets zapped and you're done. It's over with. So you seriously have to work out. You seriously have to join the military. I don't care who you are, unless you have a serious handicap, you have to pick up a gun and fight for the space that it is, or represent the space that you are then inhabiting. Everyone has to eat. Like, we have to do our very, very best to the soils on up, soils to the grasses, to the insects, to the snakes, the invertebrates, everything from the soils on up. We are looking at this entire ecosystem to benefit that habitat, that ecosystem starts there. If we did all of that as people, I wonder where we would be as a population and what we would be as a people, right? Rather than what we are now. And this element of conservation goes far beyond kill an animal or don't kill an animal. It's, and I'll be honest with you, when I hunt, am I a conservationist? Absolutely. I do not need to kill an animal. I spend a lot of time in the woods, trying to improve the woods, trying to improve the grasses, plant more native grasses, get more. One of the biggest projects that I was ever part of is basically converting a farm field and a farm pond into a wetland and back into native grasses. And I went back to this project over the years, and going from seeing nothing there to years later, going there and seeing garter snakes everywhere and frogs and turtles and fish and egrets and blue herons, is a total ecosystem change from being a row crop and this cesspool that's probably full of glyphosate to this bustling kind of metropolis of wildlife. And I just think, I think it's all interconnected. And I think unless we really start paying attention, you know, you have this, it's a massive disconnect. I know, or I've talked to so many people that really have no idea what's out in the woods. They have no idea what's in the fields. They have no interest in it whatsoever because they're not a hunter. They're not a fisherman. They don't care. But really, like, when I hunt, it's entirely selfish. When that sun comes up, I'm it's soul food for me. When I see an eastern bluebird, when I see a red-backed woodpecker, when I see a white-tailed deer or an elk, or I see a snake or I see a trout, anytime I can steal any of these images, I'm a billionaire. That's my money. I'm just as guilty as the next guy. If you're sitting in New York City in a high rise, geeked out into your computer, not even existing, and you're not doing anything for conservation, when I'm sitting there in a tree stand or I'm hiking across a mountain, I'm also, you know, I'm just stealing these images because it's the life that I want to live. But I'm fixated on this conservation idea and preservation idea because I know how happy a person can be if they move their body, eat the right food, and take a look at their surroundings, and it's wild.
Yeah, and we have to have the places for people to do that. It, you know, that the project you're talking about at a micro level, as a species, imagine what we could do if we could align that became the priority, what we could do at a macro level, or at least open the conversation. My worry is that environment you described with Wally, I'm slowly and continuously trending towards people actually might make the decision for their life to be like that out of absolute pure convenience and this myopic inability or unwillingness to detach from, hey, if I pick up my phone, I don't need to go hunt because beep, I hit a button and the groceries show up, or I can summon a car out of the ether. It's, you know, they might be a billionaire in New York and they might be attached to their computer. And I am supportive of people choosing to live their life however they want to, as long as it's not negatively impactful to others. But there is a difference between that person existing in the world and what you described when the sun comes up and the experiences out in nature, and somebody who is partaking in the world. They both exist, but you're actually partaking and walking through metaphorically and physically the environment that we all need to continue to thrive. But I think people would choose the Wally, and I don't know why. And it scares the shit out of me.
I agree with you. I honestly think that when I, you know, sometimes when I'm driving and I listen to Joe You know, Joe always has these great guests on that you otherwise wouldn't be able to hear talk in a candid fashion and not have canned responses. So, you know, I listen to a lot of Joe, and when I hear people like Elon on there, I immediately connect Elon to Wally. Not that Elon wants to have the degradation of the world, but an Elon-esque type person who is so smart and so forward-thinking that he's taking us out off of our planet into the cosmos. And there's all these systems that are being set up and potentials and possibilities. And you know, it wasn't until, Andy, have you read the book that I was a very small part of called The Comfort Crisis?
Yes. Yes, I have.
Michael Easter, the guy that wrote that book, he did an article on me in Men's Health magazine in 2018. And so he came, I brought him on an elk hunt, the very elk hunt that I described you where I shot that bull at 18 yards. He came on that hunt and he'd ask me all these questions. We'd get out of our tents in the morning. We were at 10,000 feet in Nevada in the Shell Creek Range, and we get out of our tents and he'd come sit by me, and I loved it because he'd sit down next to me and he'd, you know, he'd have this little like panel puff on it, and he's like, "Hey, are you cold?" I'm like, "Yeah, I'm cold." He's like, "How come you don't look cold?" I'm like, "Well, I'm at peace with it. Like, I like the suffer a little bit. Like, I know the next time I have a warm jacket on, I'm going to think of now when I'm cold. When I'm hungry and I have a pizza again someday, I really want to enjoy that pizza. I want to be in that moment and be thinking about the drippy cheese and the crust and what the chef did in the back room. And same when I'm scared. When I'm scared, if I get charged by a bear, I get stuck on a cliff, I've literally been stuck on a cliff. Ice all around me. If I slip, I'm going to lose my life and think to myself, man, I can't wait to get off of this cliff so I can think back to the emotion that I was feeling on that cliff. Like, I'm really scared right now, but I'm going to just take a deep breath and just do my deal. And he'd ask me all these questions. Why aren't you cold? Yeah. Hey, are you hungry? Yeah, I'm hungry. You know, he's thirsty. Yeah. Hey, we're almost out of water. We have to drop 1,000 feet to go get water and come back up. And he asked me all these things. And he asked me why. I didn't know. And he'd say, hey, so why do you hunt? And originally, when somebody says, hey, why do you hunt? I remember the first time National Geographic is the first one to ask me why I hunt. They wanted to do a TV show. And I wanted to do a TV show at National Geographic. They wanted me to go do all this silly stuff, finding Bigfoot, all these different animal things. But I wanted to do a TV show at National Geographic where I would go and live with hunters around the world, tribes of people that still hunted, still fish, still forage for their lifestyle. But I wouldn't hunt with them. It's not that I was trying to go and hunt all these places for free. I would go and assist them in their hunt, carry their meat, carry their spears, whatever it may be, help them build a bridge across the river, whatever. And I wanted to go exist in these cultures, hunt and fish with them, and then come back and kind of storytell around them. But he'd ask me, Michael would ask me all these questions, and then I didn't know as to why. And then when National Geographic asked me, I didn't know as to why. I went to answer the question. The young lady, her name was Naima. She was a producer. She said, hey, why do you hunt? I was like, oh, I hunt, you know, the sunrises, you see the birds. But why? And I was like, oh, because, then I was like, holy shit, I don't know why. And then I started looking into, why do people hunt? Where did hunting come from? Why is it that hunters, and then that's when I really started to understand society and hunters and gatherers and where we came and where we're going. And then I did a little short film for National Geographic called Who We Are. I don't know if you've seen it. If you look it up. That was never supposed to be public. I made that for National Geographic to try to convince them to let me do that TV show that I wanted to do. And so then the director and my business partner, Colin Nicolai, he's like, hey, I want to make this public. And I said, absolutely not. I talk about PETA in it. I talk about vegetarianism. I said, absolutely not. And then finally, he's like, I'm going to put it out there. let's give it a week and then we can retract it. But it went very, very well. And but through all these questions with Michael and with Naima, Michael then came back to me after he wrote The Comfort Crisis, or while he was writing The Comfort Crisis. He'd go talk to these professors at Harvard and Yale and Stanford, and go talk to Tibetan monks and all of these people that are much brighter than I am and have much more clarity than I do and much more wisdom. And they came to him basically and said, this is the healthiest you can live. This is, you'll have the best memory. You'll have the most cognitive creativity. Your skin will be the healthiest. You'll have the most muscle. You'll be able to run the fastest, take the deepest breath, swim, you know, all of these things of where you are flourishing. And then I was like, that's why I do this, because I'm coming away with a high. I'm coming away with a fitness that makes me feel like a suitable partner and father and husband and whatever else that it is, and contributor to my society, war fighter. That's why I'm doing it. It comes from our original societies trying to literally have differential reproductive success, to be born as a baby, grow as a man, have sex with a woman that has a baby. And we perpetuate as a society, and we do so in a very careful and measured manner. Of course, we've escaped that now. But that's why conservation is so important. That's why we hunt, because that's how we flourish. That's who we are as a people. That's where we do our very, very best. And it's just like, I think you probably, and I've never been in the military. I should have probably gone, but I think it's probably the same thing when you guys are doing your job.
Yeah, there's, you know, the military is a melting pot. People come in for a variety of reasons, everything from a deep sense of service and purpose to lifting and shifting their socioeconomic status. I serve with people who are extremely wealthy and people who came from abject poverty. But when it comes down to the machine needing to make the sausage on target, you're thinking purely about protecting the people to your left and right. Service and serving others, something greater than beyond yourself. You're not thinking about yourself in the moment, aside from the fact of probably being utterly terrified and worried that you were going to make a mistake that'll have a negative impact on somebody's life. And that gives you a context and lens and color that you can view the world through, just like you're talking about somebody who is a hunter-gatherer lifestyle, which you and I can both agree that it's not possible for a lot of people, but also ignoring the environment shouldn't be done. And it is very possible for people, I think, to pay attention and have conversations and study and do things that will positively impact the environment that we're living in. And what I would add to what you were describing, what you get from the hunting, you're also a frontline explorer and reporter as to the global decisions that we are making and the impact that they are having out in those wild places. It brings you right back to that conservation. You were literally the frontline reporter seeing in real time the impact that our greater global decisions are having on the wildlife and wild places. I think it's an incredibly important role. For all the parents out there, I think it's safe to speak for all of us that our main concern is always wanting to and being able to provide and protect for our kids. Fall is all about back to school and back to routine and having a checklist. And the most important task that you could ever have on your checklist should be securing your family's financial future, starting with life insurance. Fabric by Gerber Life makes it quick, easy, and affordable to protect your family so you can get back to enjoying your life. Fabric was designed by parents for parents to help you get a high quality, surprisingly affordable term life insurance policy in less than 10 minutes. Yes, you heard me say that correctly. Less than 10 minutes. You could go from start to covered in less than 10 minutes with no health exam required. There's no risk to apply. They have a 30-day money-back guarantee, and you can cancel at any time. Fabric has more than just life insurance. Their easy digital platform also lets you create wills, access college saving funds, and manage your family's finances right from your phone, so your family is prepared for anything. You can join the thousands of parents who trust Fabric to protect their family by applying today in just minutes at meetfabric.com/changeagents. That's meetfabric.com/changeagents. Policies are issued by Western Southern Life Assurance Company, and they're not available in certain states. Prices subject to underwriting and health questions.
I'm really proud to be a hunter. I wish I was more, and I don't like to be, I think there's bad news everywhere and I hate the negativity, but I'm really proud to be a hunter. I wish I was more proud of hunting right now. You know, like the hunting costs are insane and access is insane. Yeah. And the competitiveness between us as hunters is absolutely bonkers. The fact that hunters get in arguments with one another or can't appreciate someone else's techniques or application is just absolutely bonkers. And the thing that's really bonkers to me is the guys that want to shortcut things. Now, people will say the compound bow is a shortcut to the traditional bow. I don't agree. People will say that the, and I have these funny feelings, but people will say that the high powered rifle is a shortcut to the compound bow. I don't agree. And people will say that, also that rifles are a shortcut to the muzzleloader. And I don't agree. I just think that all of these weapons have seasons and lengths and opportunity that need to be reflective of their, of how easy or difficult it is to master. My biggest hang up in weaponry is, you know, is the crossbow, because it used to be that you had to have a handicap or be of a certain age to use a crossbow during archery season. I think that should definitely still be the case. Because I think it does a disjustice to us as a population of hunters and to wildlife to shortcut these things. And same with some of the instrumentation that we use and some of the just, I think hunters are using far too many shortcuts and thus compromising their own experience in the wilderness, their own woodsmanship, whether that be knot tying, fire starting, shelter building, we're short stroking our experiences because we're trying to go to A to B as fast as possible. It's like using a fish finder, right? When you use all these electronics to find your fish, is it still fun catching fish? Absolutely. Is it fun learning the electronics? Absolutely. However, when you're sitting in the canoe with your grandpa and you're in Canada or wilderness somewhere, upstate New York, Northern California, or wherever it is, and you're paddling around this crystal clear lake or however, and you're casting to a shoreline, or you're casting to a log that's floating by, and you have no idea what's around, and you catch the biggest fish of your life. Those are the kinds of experiences that I think we're truncating down and shortcutting ourselves. And I think I wish hunters and hunting still reflected men going afield and women, should that be, but men and women going afield to experience the things that I listed out before, and to, should they be lucky enough, take home a deer hide, some meat, and potentially a coat rack for the cabin or for the home.
Yeah, I think the hack culture is likely one of the most dangerous things to have happened to the human species. This, you know, 4-hour work week, or a hack to fitness, or a hack, fill in the blank. In my experience, at least anecdotally, the hack is putting in the time and effort and learning via mistakes and taking the time to build that experience. You know, that it's interesting, the hunting tools that you talked about, I could care less how people choose to hunt. I just want them to hunt ethically. And the hack culture can sneak its way into that as well, because you can choose a tool with things where you think you're going to get the edge, but you don't put in the requisite time, energy, experience to understand the capabilities or how to even use it properly. Or even just the equipment people take into the field. The number of people I have encountered who have all the whiz-bang things on them but don't know how to use them doesn't make you any safer or more successful. It's an interesting budget that they're playing with, but it's certainly like that's a cool toy that you don't know how to use or turn on. Kudos to you. Yeah, the experience and the time to me, and again, you and I have, I think, made choices in our life that have allowed us or prioritized those experiences and therefore color how we view the world. It's not one I think everybody can make, but I do believe that as a culture and society that we would be better if more people took the time to do so.
I agree. I think so. I think if we could take people into the woods, if we could take them into the wilderness, that we could, you could change their lives. Similarly, you know, in a fashion that I think if you took most people and ran them through a workout, a real workout, that I think at the end of it, they'd feel like a million bucks. And I heard this, I can't think of his name right now. I was just listening to a guy who's a Green Beret, I think. And he was talking about, like if you're down in the dumps, do like 20 burpees or something like that. And it's funny that stuff actually works. Like if you actually do, instead of sitting on your couch and self-sabotaging and doing a lot of self-loathing, which I've done so much in my life, it's not even funny. And you get off the couch and you do 20 burpees, or you do 50 burpees, or you do mountain climbers for 60 seconds. Like suddenly everything is all better. And I heard Rogan say this one time too. He was doing, I don't know what all his little stupid things that he does with his friends, but he's doing like some fitness challenge.
Oh God, the Sober October fitness challenge.
Really did like 6 hours of working out.
Yeah. But that was with the goal of just trying to beat his friends. They almost put each other in the graves for the ability to say that they won, which is probably the marquee feature of a man. We will kill ourselves to try to win useless shit.
The grave just.
Yep.
Yes. And I remember he was talking about something. He went home and his wife had some major issue. She was like, Joe, A, B, C, D. And he's like, great. Like he had worked out so hard. He had so many endorphins flowing and he felt so great about life and himself that he was like, yeah, house burned down. Cool. Was it warm? Great. We'll start building a new one tomorrow. And, do you know who Davis Love is, the golfer?
Yes.
I was fortunate. He invited me to go turkey hunting on his plantation years ago when I went. And he was just the nicest guy in the world, literally the nicest human being I've ever met in my life. And I got word last year, the year before, 2 years ago, I got word from another mutual friend of ours that his house had burned down. So I text him right away. His house had burned down the night before. Okay, so his house had just burned down. And I text him, I said, Davis, I got word from Tommy. You lost your house last night in a fire. I'm so sorry. I hope everyone's okay. Please let me know if you need anything. He's always extended a gracious hand to me for anything that I would ever need. And he messaged me back. He goes, yes, we did lose the house last night. He goes, but everyone's okay. Thank goodness everyone's okay. And I'm having a beautiful breakfast with my wife right now. And we're just kind of mulling over things and memories that we had in that house. And just having a blessed morning. And I hope you are as well, Donnie. I hope, you know, the sunshine finds you this morning. You have a great day. And I'm just thinking, who in the world finds that level of acceptance and balance? And it, that's somebody who has really worked their butt off for what they, who they are, and they appreciate the seconds as they tick by. And that's the, you know, like, you know, the term entropy, right? Yep. Andy.
Yep.
When I learned entropy, I'll never forget this, sitting in a massive college room and they're talking about entropy and this continued state of disorder. And, you know, and my professor's like, you know, for all practical purposes, this, you know, this table that I'm standing behind is rusting, you know, it's wasting away. And I'm an idiot kid. And I'm like, is it? And he's like, well, you know, for, he's like, the wooden top is quite literally on fire right now. It's degrading, right? The molecules are, it's going through cellular decay right now. And so are you. And as the seconds tick by, and I thought, holy, it just was such an eye-opener to me. And at that time, I had an old Labrador that I had been hunting with. And when I got home from that class, I just took her on a walk and I was like, I'm not wasting any more time with her. Like, I'm not going to not walk you. We're not going to hang out tonight. And I'm going to read to you tonight. And people always say, live your life like you're dying. You can't. None of us can live our lives like we're dying. If you were dying, you never would have become a Navy SEAL. If I was dying, I never would do the work that I'm doing. We would just selfishly and probably wrongly suck onto our kids or our girlfriends or our wives or our parents. We would just glom onto the thing that was closest to us and we would just wither away. But we can mimic that as best we can possibly in the manner of when you're driving your truck, when you're taking a walk, when you're loading your gun, when you're washing dishes, clipping your toenails, you can have a presence of where you're not letting seconds tick by. We're just doing a stupid podcast right now. You're in Montana. I'm in Illinois right now. But I very much appreciate this time that I get to speak to somebody like you. And I'm looking at this. I'm considering this as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I'm thinking about this, Andy, as though I'm never going to be able to shake your hand. I'm never going to be able to talk to you again. And while I'll continue to learn about you and your career from a tertiary standpoint, reading books and listening to podcasts, I may never see you again. I hope that's not the case, but this is how I'm going to treat this moment, because I want this moment to be really special. And it's just like engaging in any wildlife or doing any work in our lives. And I think we need to do this more as people, whereas I think we just kind of tumble through space and we don't really realize, of course this comes with age, but we don't really realize our age brackets, right? I'm 48. I'm going to turn 49 in October.
What day in October?
When I meet 29th.
I turn 46 on the 10th.
Oh, you do? Well, happy pre-birthday.
And same to you.
And so I just think about this stuff. And I think in our 20s, we don't know what our 20s means. I mean, if we could go back right now, I mean, you'd probably not change a thing. I would change a bunch of things.
Oh, I would change a bunch of things. My occupation would still be the same, but I would really, really round the edges on my personal life.
Okay. So I would have definitely gone into the military. I didn't realize what the military was until it was maybe too late for me. And I just wanted to be outside and I wanted to be near wildlife. But then now that I'm older, and this is just, I'm not pushing this on you or anyone else, and this is my own self-degradation. I think to myself, with my mindset, how my body is shaped, how my mind works, I should have been an asset to my country in the time frame that I could have been, and then looked and then started going outside and chasing wildlife. I just think it was a disservice to the United States and to other people who actually signed up and strapped the boots on. I just feel like I probably short-stroked my responsibilities in that manner. But I didn't have a mentor as such, and I zigged when I should have zagged. And I, of course, I would change a bunch of things as well in my life. And I just think that even though that's the case, I'm 48 now, we have to look at the seconds that are coming now and presenting themselves to us and digesting them entirely without letting them slip by. And then understanding that the wisdom that we have now is the wisdom that we have now, and try to use that as much as we can to get to 55, 65, 75. I mean, I could die in an airplane crash on this coming Saturday. I'm flying into a very dangerous place. It would not be a shock to anyone. But should that not happen, or even if it does happen, we're going to continue to live our lives to as fullest as we can, live life sort of like we're dying, but not really.
Yeah, it's tough to appreciate life until you get to a place where you realize there's more sand in the bottom of the hourglass than there is at the top.
Yes.
When I was 20, yes, or even before that, as a young child, you know, your perspective of time, getting from the morning into the afternoon was longer than anybody's ever lived before. It was an insurmountable task. And then yet a week would go by at a time, and I don't even remember my 20s largely. 30s, the same thing. And now I'm in my 40s thinking about that hourglass more. And it certainly shapes the way that I view the world. I tell you what, though, Donnie, I hope one day that you are able to come to peace with not serving in the military. And I say that because I've met a lot of people, and people reach out to me very often with emails or in person, and they want to talk about how they feel poorly about not serving in the military. And I say the same thing to them, regardless, honestly, of what direction they come to it from. There's a lot of ways that you can serve. I've been to some countries. Singapore is a good example. 2-year mandatory service. Is it a perfect system? No. Do I personally think that 2 years of mandatory service would be a really good thing for society in the United States? I absolutely do. But I would caveat that with, I don't think it needs to be in the military. I would say Doctors Without Borders, Red Cross, whatever it may be, just take 2 years at a formidable time in your physical and mental development and go serve something greater than yourself. Not everybody is well suited to be in the military. There are disqualifying factors from a physical perspective, a mental perspective, emotional perspective, and the job, man, it carries some weight depending on how far you take the job and what you do with it. And it will give you a lens that you can view the world through, but it's not a complete lens. Like I was telling you at the beginning, I came to hunting and understanding wilderness and my thoughts on conservation and wanting to sustain it for not only myself, but future generations later in life. You, I would say, with your experience, your knowledge, and the platforms that you have been able to develop, whether it's being on Joe's podcast, talking about, you know, your experiences in Alaska, where you were spending, you know, months at a time alone counting the salmon, and your interactions with wolves and livestock, and or not livestock, but just in the wilderness, and the way that you've been able to tell that story, that is a service that is just as important, if not more important, than people who are serving the military. The military, it's such a, I think 0.05% of the U.S. population is serving the military now. There are so many other things that we need people to invest their time in that can bring attention to things like conservation. You could have done 20 years in the military and you may never have had the experiences that you have had now, the lessons that you learned, the knowledge that you have, the people that you have met. And without that, the world would not be as good of a place as it is with you in it. That what you are doing and what you have done is a level of service. And the mistake people make, I think, is they try to measure one against the other. And that is, in fact, the mistake. You have educated countless people when it comes to wildlife or conservation. I mean, I don't know how you put a metric onto that, but I'm glad that you chose that path as opposed to military service, because it's important. I mean, what we're talking about with your experience and hopefully drawing people's eyes towards conservation and things in the future is decision-making and hopefully policy-making that can help sustain our species. I didn't do any of that shit in the military. I was trying to, you know, a dam with some water spouting out of it. I was trying to put my finger in a hole. You were building a better dam.
I appreciate that. And I've heard that, I've heard that sentiment. One other person, I do a lot of work with True Velocity, a company out of Texas.
They just sent me some bullets, actually.
Oh, they did?
Yeah.
Oh, really cool.
I'm going to go shoot some shit with them later this year.
They send you 308?
They did, yeah. I asked them. I said 300 Win Mag is my just default favorite round because I have the most experience with it. They sent me some 308, which is awesome because that's what my wife, the caliber of round she's been hunting with, so it's perfect. But I did ask if they have any old 300 Win in the production pipeline, because I would certainly like to test that out.
Yeah, and they're gonna come with a host of calibers. I think they're 6.8, 5.56, they're 6.8, and then 50 cal is next because they're focused on militarily. Yep. But then beyond that, they'll start cranking out some serious calibers. But I heard this from one of the I get to meet some men like yourself in filming with them. They bring on some very talented current and retired military guys, and one of the guys was not a probing. He's a Green Beret. He's an active service Green Beret, but he was just like, man, I love what you've kind of professed and the life that you've lived and the education that you've given us and so that was cool to hear his perspectives. And I told him, you know, same thing I told you. I said, yeah, I feel like I had a misstep. And he's like, not at all. He's like, what would be without you of doing this? You know, he's like, what would we be talking about? Who would be talking about these things? And I appreciate it. It's just something that wildlife for me is, I never even thought of a career. When I got out of high school, all I thought about was getting outside. The only reason I even got a biology degree was because I thought wildlife biologists, fishery biologists got to work outside and got to contribute to habitat and wildlife and build systems. And they do. But I also realized that there's other elements to that need to be sidestepped for me personally. And I didn't want to work myself into an office and then the politics of things. I have no idea how people become politicians and how we've built systems. I obviously understand democracy, but how we've built systems of how politics, whether that be fish and game departments, police departments, fire departments, president of the United States, there is so much stuff that happens behind the scenes. Yeah. I don't know how we've gotten to the point where we have as a society where we to trust and believe in anything, really.
Well, it's an interesting segue from a conservation perspective. Put your conservationist hat on. From a policy perspective, talking about those individuals, which I am more and more resoundingly landing that they are in service to serve themselves as opposed to serve the people that elected them there, which nobody seems to be paying attention to. That's a podcast in and of itself. What would you, from a conservationist perspective, policy-wise, is there anything that you think could be implemented that would make a substantial and sweeping difference?
Yeah, I think so. I think if, you know, kind of along the lines of having habitat restorations, let's just say projects that people do in different regions to kind of reclaim wildlife. I talked about that piece that I took care of years ago. It was 26 or 27 acres with a little pond. It was a row crop. The first time I was introduced to the field, I was standing in rubber boots, mid-calf, nearly knee-deep mud, and the pond was horrible, disgusting. Fast forward to the field being overhead high of big blue stem and switchgrass and milkweed and insects and snakes and turtles and frogs. And that was 27 acres. And I saw a cornucopia of life start to exist there in just a few years. I think, and this is where, and I do struggle with this, right? Because we're human beings and we, on one hand, we have to hypervalue human life. Now, on the other hand, I think we kind of have to be real with one another. You know, sometimes this is a subject whiplash, but sometimes I'll have people that I know, they call me Andy, or they'll message me and be like, oh, I'm so sad today. My grandmother died. And I'll say, oh, okay, I'm sorry to hear that. You know, how old is she? 98. And I'm just heartbroken about it. I'm like, what are you heartbroken about?
She's not heartbroken. Your 98-year-old grandmother is super stoked that her time is done.
Yeah, like I assure you she was ready to go. Yeah. And so I think about, we hypervalue human life, but I also think about what if we started to, the system that you and I were talking about earlier with in reintroducing wolves into an ungulate population, then the wolves come up, the ungulates come down, and then we have this ebb and flow, and then God forbid we start to get these big egresses and then the wolves die off, and then so we get these things. But with human beings, we just keep adding more wolves. And the elk went from 500 head, they're now down to like 4 head, but we keep just adding wolves into the system. And so what would happen if we started to say, okay, we are now not approving certain big businesses, right? We're going to reel in on big pharmaceuticals. We are going to reel in on big factory farms. A certain level of land. We cannot bypass a certain level of land, a certain level of water pollution. We have to restore a certain level to the detriment of, you know, this is the tricky part, is because we, as our human population continues to go basically one way, and thus food production and housing production, land development continues to go one way. But what if we started to reclaim things? Like, I'll give you a for instance. What if we had, you were only allowed to build a Walmart. You couldn't build a Walmart any closer to another Walmart. It had to be at least 200 miles away or something like that, within driving distance of an automobile. Even though people say, well, I'm not driving 200 miles to go to a Walmart. Okay, but at some point, we can't have a Walmart in every town. We can't have a Home Depot in every town. We can't have these parent companies owning 80% of the global brands or 70% of the global brands. We can't have all of these systems and have our wild spaces continue to have preservation or grow. And I think if we started to knock some of these systems down, maybe this is going to sound horrible when I say it out loud, but maybe we reduce the footprint of housing that's allowed for people, or we reduce how many condominiums are allowed, or how many, whatever it may be, but we have to do something. There has to be a restrictor plate, because otherwise we're going to continue to trend in this direction. I just had a friend of mine purchase a lot to build a home on a wild bluff overlooking this wild and scenic river in Wisconsin. And the piece of land that he bought, he is now building a $12.5 million home that is basically encompassing the entire lot that he purchased. It's one giant house. I was talking to him the other day and he said, "What do you think?" I said, "I think you're an idiot. And I think this thing looks horrible. And I think you've done a great disservice to your kids. So they're not going to understand, like, why are they walking out their front door?" And you just gobbled up as much land as possible because you could.
Yeah.
And until we stop as a society or as a people gobbling up as much resources as we can because we can, it's going to be a really short rope that's going to get really short. And so I think you could implement some hard and fast rules to restrict what people can do with wild places and incentivize restoration, but man, it's going to be tough.
Yeah. You know, the things you're describing, they're only difficult to wrap your head around if you don't explain the reasoning for it. It would require people to make decisions that may seem as if they're directly in contradiction to their own self-interest, but only in the short term, because what you're talking about is long-term survival and sustainability. I would like to believe that people can step outside of themselves and look on a timeline that is perhaps longer than their own lifetime. I have my doubts, is the polite way to say it.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's as though you go to the chronic, because what are they going to say, Andy, when, let's just say it's 2023 right now, let's just say 2050, the president of the United States comes on the TV and says, we're basically out of resources. Like, we're out of wild places. We have to come up with different systems to grow food, whatever it may be. A catastrophic end of road, a total use of resources. Well, all these people are then going to look at each other and be like, "Oh, how come we didn't change when we had the chance?" It's like the lifelong smoker getting told that he or she has lung cancer, and then saying to the doctor, like, "Where were you when I was 14 and I started smoking?" It's like, no, there are warning signs everywhere. But as long as this computer turns on and water comes out of the faucet and our cars turn over, we can go and buy gas. As long as we can do all those things, we're going to keep trending in our own merry little world. And I was actually saying this to a friend of mine recently, the whole metaverse, where like Zuckerberg and all these guys were hoping that people would start building stores and buying stores and living in the metaverse, like meeting girls in the metaverse. And I thought to myself, my first thought was, I'm an idiot, and I was literally thinking, I must be so dumb that when I see the sun come up or a flock of crows flying over communicating with one another, or I see a praying mantis walking up a branch, or I see a flock of geese landing into a field, that is so entertaining to me. I would never, ever, not for any reason, would I spend a single solitary second, not for money, not for joy, not for sex, not for anything, would I spend any time in the meta universe. And so I thought to myself, okay, are the people that understand the meta universe and are going there and going to make billions of dollars and engaging in the metaverse, are these the smart people? And then people like me that really want to see the praying mantis walk up the branch and watch the sun come up and watch a thunderstorm roll across the Midwest or the Alaska tundra, are we the idiots? Because we're so simply and easily entertained. And then I started thinking also, is this going to be a good thing, Andy? Are all the people that don't care going to go into the meta universe and stay there and grow fat and sassy on their lab grown meat? And then guys like you and I, meat eaters, are going to be able to go outside, stand in our farms or our ranches, or stand in our wilderness, shake hands, crawl in our tents, shoot our bows, fly fish, shoot elk, whatever it is. Are they going to leave these wild spaces that hold little to no value to them? Are they going to leave all of these to us? and they're just going to, like Wally, they're going to get on the spaceship. And then I started kind of thinking, well, maybe there's a silver lining here, but I don't know what's going to happen. But I would say the majority is trending towards Wally, and the minority are reading the books, paying attention, and kind of understanding that our wild world is shrinking down. And I just don't mean for hunting. Like, a lot of people might think this is a selfish, intrinsic motivation, so I can kill a big bull elk. No, we can stop hunting. Like, if you said, hey, we're going to stop hunting altogether, you know, you have the option of buying really good ranch raised meat from a rancher that really, really understands soils and grasses and fresh water, and you can buy meat from him, but we're going to stop hunting, but we're going to pour into these habitat projects. Sign me up. Let's do it. Cause I'll show up to the same valley. I'll get up at the same time at 2 a.m. I'll hike up on the same ridge to watch the elk rut, to hear them bugle, to see the wolves chase him, to see the grizzly bears. I'm there for the show. If I don't get to shoot one, that's fine. As long as I am able to shoot one and source my own meat, put me to the front of that line. But if we can't, put me to the front of the conservation line and actually generating these systems, because I still bet even the anti-hunters, even the non-hunters, Andy, they're still not going to show up for the show. Even if there's no hunting, they're still not showing up.
I would agree with you on that. And I would make the same choice. If I was given the choice of you can continue to hunt, but the conservation efforts are going to wane, and eventually the people who are plugged into the Wally world, they'll leave you alone until they need what you have, and then they're going to come for you at full force. That's your choice. You can hunt and wait for them to come for you, or you could stop hunting right now and preserve this for your kids and future generations and for the world in general, but you could still go out and enjoy it. I'm there on the ladder in a heartbeat.
100%. Have to be.
Yeah.
Because we have to, these systems being healthy and being able to push our bodies, eat good food, drink good water, be around good people, read good books, look at good art, and live what is organized society as a human being. And do these things. I don't care if you're a mountain man or you live in downtown New York. If you have this presence, you know, that's the life I want to be in. Those are the people that I want to be around. And I don't really want anything. I messaged, my business partner yesterday, and I'm dead serious. I said, hey, I didn't say do this, but I said, basically effective immediately, I want to shut down my Instagram page and Facebook page. I want to get off of social media altogether. And he texted me back and he's like, okay, we need to have a larger discussion about this before we're going to do this. Did something happen? I need to understand. And I, you know, I messaged back and with kind of an LOL, which I don't do, but his response did make me laugh. Cause I pictured his face reading my response saying, hey, I want to shut down my social platforms immediately. But, you know, and then hearing somebody like you say, hey, like your voice is helping. Well, that makes me not want to shut down my social channels and stop writing. And I had another friend yesterday. I know I'm all over the place, Andy, but I had a friend yesterday recommend that I start using ChatGPT to write my post for Instagram. And I just thought,
I don't see that as being something you would want to do. That's like anti-Donnie.
Why? Like sitting there, it's just like we talked about, sitting there looking at the screen, the cursor, and not knowing what to write. Like I look at this picture of a bear, or look at this picture of a fish or the sunset or whatever, and I just think Northern Lights, whatever it is, and I just think, what was I thinking right then? What was the light like? What was the weather like? Where was my, and then I start writing. That's the process. I can't type in mule deer, Alberta, September, archery, and have ChatGPT, right? I had a photography professor one time. We had this project. It was a final project, a senior project. We had to go shoot a series of photos that had to be related. They didn't have to be the same subject matter, but they had to be related. And And I was working in a hospital at the time in cardiovascular surgery, and I got permission to take my camera into an angioplasty where they put stents in somebody's heart. So I went in there and I took photos of the patient. I got the patient's permission. I took a photo of the patient and I took photos of the work and the big needles. And I took some pictures of, he had a compromised femoral artery and was bleeding everywhere, tons of blood. And I got cool photos of the blood just rocketing out of his leg. And then all this other different stuff. And I presented the photos to my professor and in the end, he goes, "I really like this photo." And it was a needle going under the skin. You could see a tent of skin over the needle and then blood. You could see an arterial flow. It was I got the very first arterial flow coming out of this needle, out of this catheter. And my professor was like, "I really like this one." But one of the photos, Andy, was the physician covered in blood, his face covered in blood, blood all over the floor. And I was like, "You don't like this one?" He's like, "No, I like this one." I said, "Why?" And he said, "I'll never forget this, whether it be talking to a woman, talking to a friend, on a hunt, whatever it be." He said, "Every single time, the closer we are to something, the more interesting it becomes. Doesn't matter what it is." And I thought, that is true in every single thing. The closer we become to it, the more interesting it becomes. And so I started, you know, like when I shoot a deer or when I'm planting seeds or whatever, like if I'm literally looking at the seed, literally looking at the soil, literally looking at the finite little details of the day, flowers, bumblebees. Like if I hold a bumblebee to you 10 feet away and then I put a bumblebee under a microscope, you are by far the most entertained under the microscope. Now you might be entertained, quite entertained to watch that bumblebee do his work going flower to flower to flower to flower. But if you put it all together, you really kind of develop this experience and kind of what you've went through. It's just like, I'm sure it's the same thing with you militarily. There's one option is to fly a fighter plane over a
30,000 foot view.
Bombs. The other one is to go house to house. And I'm sure it's scary as hell to go house to house, but I'll bet your senses are 10 times out of the pilot.
I would agree for sure. A lot of people, though, are going to say, "Well, I don't have the time necessarily or the opportunity to do so." And to answer them or to point them in a place where they can at least gather more information, are there any organizations that you would point people towards to educate themselves and potentially get involved with?
Oh, man, that's a really good question. Well, first of all, I think this is high level, but I think everyone should read The Comfort Crisis, not to plug Michael Easter's book, but really read about the things that he writes about and try to reflect that in your own life and doing difficult things, scary things, hard things, and getting outside to see sunlight and all these different things for you as a human being. The other book that I would highly recommend right out of the gate is to read Aldo Leopold's Sand County Almanac. Have you read that?
I have not.
Yeah, read that book, Andy. It's life-changing. He's an ecologist. He's a professor out of Wisconsin. He buys a rundown old farm, and he writes so eloquently about bringing that farm back to life and how all the systems mean. And he has a very, very good understanding as to who human beings really are. He knows who the banker is. He knows who the farmer is. And he knows the payment plan that they're looking for and the payment that the land is going to have to go through. But beyond that, I think organizations, I'll say this, because I think it's vastly important. I think he's doing brilliant work. A very good friend of mine, Sam Soholt, this is just one man, but he does a project every year called Stamp It Forward, because every dollar that is spent to buy federal duck stamps, every single dollar of that money goes towards habitat reproduction and restoration. And so he does a program every year. He just got done doing a 100-mile hike in South Dakota for it. He's trying to raise $100,000 this year, which sounds so silly, But literally that $100,000 is going to go 100% to conservation. No administrative costs out of that. And out of that $100,000 is quite literally going to an individual pond or a field and going to be reclaimed and turned back into habitat. That is vastly important. So Sam Solholt's Stamp It Forward is one that I recognize right away. And then I think a lot of organizations are doing really good work as far as like Pheasants Forever. I don't know that much about like Ducks Unlimited and things like that. I don't know if these organizations are really putting their money where their mouth is, but that's a really good question, Andy, and something that I should probably look into. I know also Backcountry Hunters and Anglers does a host of things, but I also don't know, boot leather to the ground, like what they're really touching. Are there any that you've come in contact with that you know of?
Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation has seemed to be a good one. My advice generally for people is to start locally. You know, look at where you're at and do a little bit of research, and also what aligns with your passion. Like for me, the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation or Western type hunting, super passionate about it because it's out my back door. But Illinois, maybe you're more interested in whitetail conservation, or, you know, you're worried about CWD or other thing, or duck hunting wherever you are. I think it really depends on where people are at. I think the ones that you gave are a good start, and I just would advise people to look locally and try to have that local impact, that micro-local impact that have a macro outcome.
I think that's a very wise, I think that's really wise advice. And the only thing that I would add to that on a grand scale is when you see things that are global, as long as you can find good information, but for instance, like the Pebble Mine in Alaska, you know, the degradation of Bristol Bay to us all would be a big problem in affecting the salmon runs in Western Alaska. And so I think you can look at some global efforts in different areas and kind of participate. I totally agree with you. That's why I really like, and also look at, for instance, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. They're going to alter landscapes and systems and get rid of fences. Like the things that they're doing are contributing far beyond the Rocky Mountain elk. They're a systems contributor. Just like my friend Sam Solholt with Stamp It Forward, he is harvesting dollars in a manner that he knows 100% gets spent into wetlands. And wetlands are, like, you don't even have to be a duck hunter. Wetlands are a life source of, it's like having a salmon river in Alaska. When there aren't fish in that river, the river's very quiet with wolves, very quiet with grizzly bears and eagles and ringbill gulls or herring gulls. Once you add that fish to that system, that whole, it's a lifeline. It's an artery that goes to the mountains, and all of that stuff comes to life. As I spoke to with Rogan and doing work up there, and wetlands are the same thing. Whether you're in love with the white-tailed deer or you're in love with the green heron or the, you know, marsh bittern, wetlands are going to be the source of these things. So I agree with you. I think look locally and look at habitat. A species will likely bring you to a habitat, but the smaller the unit of measurement that you can start with, soils being basically number one, soils, vegetation, insects, you start at that level and you'll grow the most fancy, handsome elk herd that you could fathom, because it all starts with the soils, grasses, and insects.
Yeah, I agree. Mr. Vincent, what would you like to close it out with? We totally blew blast the time allotted, and I don't even care because it was an awesome conversation.
I just very much appreciate your time. I know this sounds so contrived, but I really appreciate the things you did in your life and your job and your service. And I look up to men like you. I think your work is terribly important. And I just am very thankful for this conversation. Yeah, I'm going to take this conversation throughout my day, and I just very much appreciate your time and hope we get to do it again.
I really hope you all enjoyed that conversation. One of the organizations that Donnie mentioned was the Stamp It Forward Project, and that is paired with the Prairie Pothole Duck Ruck. Say that fast 3 times in a row. And if you want to learn more and get involved, you can go to publiclandtees.com/duckruck. I'm going to spell that out for you here. Public land, normal spelling on that. Tees, T-E-E S, not TEAS. I don't know why it would be the beverage. publiclandtees.com/duckruck, both normal spelling, smashed together. You can also learn more about Donnie and his films at donnievincent.com. Thank you again for listening to Change Agents, an Ironclad original. We're going to be back next week with an all-new episode. I hope you enjoy season 2.